from deep inside your radio.
Well, not from an airport hotel. That's progress. Back in the home of the homeless, that's progress. Ladies and gentlemen, if you heard last week's broadcast, you know that I was trying to ascertain whether a rumor that I was interested in, that is to say that American Airlines was going bankrupt, it's not a thing that I would desire to see, of course. I'm just curious whether that rumor could spread. And so imagine my surprise this week when I get in the mail a little thing from American Airlines. And I thought that was going to be like, hey, we're sorry about the thing that happened and we're not going bankrupt, but hey. And I don't know, maybe it is. It just says on the outside, you may discover something special on your next three trips. Ooh. It's probably, you know, has nothing to do with me. It's probably just, you know, a randomly assigned thing that just the wonders of computerized mail happened to have sent just after I was inquiring whether the rumor that American Airlines was going bankrupt had spread on the internet. But still, you know, still just a little, ooh. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the scientist, an acclaimed government scientist who assisted the federal investigation of the anthrax mailing, said this week he erred 7 years ago when he told top Bush administration officials that the material he examined probably had been altered to make it more deadly. This is from the dog trainer. Imagine that. The scientist Peter Jarling had observed anthrax spores with the aid of an electron microscope at Fort Detrick, Maryland. On October 24, 2001, he was summoned to the White House after reporting to his superiors what he believed to be signs that silicon had been added to anthrax. That was viewed with alarm because the material, if artificially added, would make it more buoyant in the air, more capable of getting into your lungs. I believe I made an honest mistake, Jarling said, adding he'd been overly impressed by what he thought he saw under the microscope, he added. Why, you ask? Jarling is a virologist, guy who studies viruses, but he was referring to his analysis of anthrax, which is a bacterium. You know, they're this close to each other. Bacterium, virus. Although Jarling was careful back then not to implicate Iraq or any other regime in the mailings, others used his analysis to allege that the silicon perhaps linked the letters to Saddam Hussein, thus helping to prepare the case for war. Just another little thing that happens when a virologist looks at a bacterium. Hello, welcome to the show.
Drink.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And on the other hand, also from the Los Angeles Dog Trainer, an article in Sunday's Section A, well, that's got to be important, about the slaying of an Afghan provincial governor said the Taliban movement ruled Pakistan until late 2001 when it was toppled by a U.S.-led invasion. It was Afghanistan that the Taliban ruled, not Pakistan. That came later. Thank you, L.A. Dog Trainer. That's a case where the L.A. Dog Trainer just saw into the future, which is now. But the global war on terror is going so well, ladies and gentlemen. How do we know? Because we've succeeded in one of our primary goals. Al-Qaeda's annual September 11th propaganda video only surfaced this week. We made them delay the release by 8 days. Come on now. That's a victory. A concerted U.S. effort to block it. According to Brian Ross at ABC News, the tape showed no new pictures of Osama bin Laden. But that's not the point. Who cares what they said? I care that we kept it out of release for 8 whole days. Just a totally different news cycle. This was the first time in 7 years that Al-Qaeda failed to get its anniversary message publicly released on or before September 11th. Think of the humiliation. They got to be eating their dogs. Well, they do anyway. U.S. officials declined to comment on what role the government played, saying its policy not to comment on sensitive intelligence operations, like keeping Al-Qaeda's tape from being released. I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, the grown-ups have the right priorities. Intelligence sources say the U.S., with the help of German and Malaysian authorities, were able to disrupt Al-Qaeda's normal internet release method. Maybe these the same people who hacked Sarah Palin's email. It's something we've been trying to do for some time, says former CIA officer John Kiriakou, now with ABC News. It's a long-sought goal, ladies and gentlemen, to delay the release of Al-Qaeda tapes. I'm telling you, I'm busting my buttons with pride. Intelligence sources say the U.S. has made major strides in infiltrating the Al-Qaeda distribution network and chose to use its knowledge this year to keep the 9/11 tape from coming out immediately, although they said they did not expect they could keep the tape permanently blocked. Quote, they are determined communicators, unquote. But, you know, 8 days, that's got to screw up the terrorists, don't you think? Maybe it's the surge, maybe it's not the surge. U.S. military officials may have taken credit where none is due for decreasing violence in Baghdad with the troop surge. This from New Scientist. By comparing the amount of light produced at night in different areas of Baghdad before, during, and after the surge, UCLA researchers were able to track the movements of the warring Sunni and Shiite factions. The amount of light was assumed to reflect the number of lights switched on in a neighborhood. Combining that with a neighborhood map showed that the lights had dimmed much more in the Sunni areas than in the Shiite areas. This change began before the surge. The light levels in four other major cities untouched by the surge remained constant or increased during the period. It seems that it was sectarian cleansing that has led to the decrease in violence as the Sunnis were cleared out, says researcher John Agnew, who researches ethnic conflict at UCLA. Why would you look at Iraq? Paul Wolfowitz told us there was no history of ethnic conflict there. Wouldn't you trust Paul? Unsurprisingly, many of the Iraqi refugees in Syria and Jordan are Sunnis from these neighborhoods, and when they left, says Agnew, they turned out the lights. The satellite images used came from a U.S. Department of Defense weather satellite. I bet Don Rumsfeld is mad enough to eat dog when he hears that. So it was a surge in ethnic cleansing, ladies and gentlemen. There was nobody left to kill. And now, the apologies of the week. As they accepted an apology from the U.S. Olympic Committee, four Olympic track cyclists reprimanded for wearing anti-pollution masks upon their arrival at the Beijing airport called for further action against two U.S. Olympic Committee staff members for their behavior in handling the issue. Oh, an apology's not enough for you guys, huh? In a Monday conference call, cyclist Sarah Hammer asked for the USOC to publicly address the issue of staff misconduct and behavior by the two. Not only did they show us absolutely no respect in our time of dire need, but they openly harassed us and belittled us. The cyclist said, a USA Olympic Committee Sports Partnerships Director humiliated them in a meeting which other athletes were present, while the chief of USOC Sports Performance sat them down privately the next morning and demanded an apology to China, Beijing, and the Beijing Olympic organizers within 2.5 hours or else. Feeling the or else could be expelled from the Olympics, the cyclists agreed to let U.S. Cycling Media Director Andy Lee write an apology for them. Now USOC Chief Executive Jim Scher apologized to the cyclists in a letter last week. It's all about the spirit of the Olympics. The saga of a Lubbock television station reporter's ill-fated attempt to test the security of nurseries at two Amarillo hospitals concluded with a short apology in last week's Amarillo Globe News. Cecilia Coy Jones was arrested in March 2007 after trying to gauge security at Baptist St. Anthony's Hospital. The untitled, unsigned apology appeared in a 2-column, 5-inch display ad. The agreement with authorities called for Coy Jones and Lubbock NBC affiliate KCBD to issue the apology and pay $600 to cover costs police incurred responding to the incident. The apology appeared in the newspaper lacked sincerity, according to the attorney for the hospital district. It also reflects an attitude of, quote, I am smarter than you are, and in this case of being above the law, he said. Even as long as I've been a prosecutor, it's still disappointing when you give people the opportunity to seize the moment, and they do not. Coy Jones was dressed in hospital scrubs and wore a small wire with a camera. When police arrested her at the hospital, she said she was making the undercover visits as a part of a series of stories. Police had arrested her on 2 charges of attempted aggravated kidnapping, second-degree felonies. The grand jury reviewed the matter and approved the agreement. People aren't happy with the apologies this week. There's a trend. Monday night's football game between the Cowboys and the Eagles got a solid apology from Tony Kornheiser, commentator on ESPN. He apologized for comment when ESPN cut to the Spanish language feed of the kickoff return for a touchdown. Kornheiser said, quote, I took high school Spanish, and that either means nobody is going to touch him or could you pick up my dry cleaning in the morning? Then he said this. I said something before I shouldn't have said. I apologize for it. Not my first mistake. Undoubtedly won't be my last, but a 100% apology. And nobody has criticized that apology yet, at least in English. But wait, there's more. Dateline Dos Palos, California, the principal of Dos Palos High School apologized this week for actions taken against a student who wore a flag shirt on campus. He was forced to take off the shirt because an administrator said it violated the school's dress code. Principal Terry Gill issued a formal apology at the school board meeting. I would like to make a formal apology to our students. That's the way principals sound, isn't it? I wouldn't know. Our community and our country, by no means was this done with the intent to ban our students from expressing their patriotism. Okay, then. That makes that clear. A new administrator read the rule at face value, and the administrator talked with me. She then realized her error. The administrator then called the parent, who did accept her sincere apology. She called in the student, who, too, accepted her apology. We're very proud to be Americans. See, that's how you accept an apology. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates almost apologized this week, expressed his regret over civilian deaths. U.S. military says it killed 5 to 7 civilians in Afghanistan. Gates was in Kabul, Afghanistan. He expressed regret over the incident in which Afghan and U.N. officials say 90 civilians, mostly women and children, were mistakenly killed in an air raid. Regret. I've got a few. President Bush called the home of Leslie and Moss Crosby during a fundraiser for congressional candidate Wayne Parker in Alabama. He apologized for not being able to attend. Vice President Dick Cheney stood in for the president. That's kind of a role reversal. No, it's not. Who stayed in Washington to meet with economic advisors? Why, what's up? The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. No, one more. What the heck? The Canadian Conservatives were forced to say they were sorry for a careless remark about Aboriginal drinking. Aboriginal protesters expressed outrage at what they described as a racist slur by a member of the transport minister's staff. Staff! Okay, the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, what's new in the digital wonderland? You know that that big switchover date is... You've been seeing the commercials, right? You're well informed. You know the big switchover from... They're going to turn off analog television and switch to digital in February. Or not. FCC Commissioner Michael Copps called on the FCC recently, within the last few days, to figure out a way for broadcasters to extend their analog broadcasts after the cutoff. This is according to Broadcasting and Cable. Copps is out of the country and wasn't available for further comment. This is a couple days after he submitted a letter to the chairman suggesting that the hard deadline of February 17th was a little severe. Why don't we just get the federal government to pay everybody to get new TVs? We got the money. Oh. The February 17th, 2009 deadline is a hard date. We have only one chance to get this right, Copps wrote. We must be prepared as much as humanly possible for whatever occurs. There is no precedent for what we are about to do. Now he's scaring me. I'm getting a little concerned. It seems, says an attorney representing North Carolina's broadcasters, it seems to me Congress should give serious consideration to stations to continue to broadcast in analog for 30 days. He told Broadcasting and Cable. Cold feet? Cold digital feet? Come on! Dive in. The digital water's fine. Or... Ladies and gentlemen, the president of Georgia seems to have been influenced a little bit by some of the bad habits of the... first, every presidential campaign engages in flummery. Flummoxation of the populace. But... most national media, yeah, I know, they're liberals, have pointed at John McCain's campaign for a plenitude of mendacity. See? Now, doesn't that sound nice? A plenitude of mendacity. So now, this week on a BBC television interview, comes the president of the country of Georgia. And he's asked by the interviewer, Stephen Sacker, about the fact, the published reports, that Georgia paid John McCain's foreign policy advisor hundreds of thousands of dollars to lobby for the country of Georgia just before said advisor, Randy Scheuneman, was told by the McCain campaign in April, oh, you can't be both a lobbyist and run our foreign affairs shop, so choose. Scheuneman's last check, reportedly, from Orion Strategies from the country of Georgia came 2 days before John McCain delivered his first speech in behalf of the country of Georgia. Anyway, here's the president of Georgia.
Nobody would deny for one second that you have fantastic PR in Washington and many supporters. Some would say that's partly because you spend millions of dollars on lobbying and PR in Washington, not least with indeed, Mr. McCain's chief foreign policy advisor, who has received a lot of money in his strategy organization from your government. So you do have PR friends. But when it comes to practicalities, what have the Americans actually done for you to stop the Russians doing what they want on your territory?
Stephen, with all due respect, you just sounded not like Mr. Putin right now. I mean, what millions of dollars, what lobbies? We are a small country that is trying to survive in very complicated geopolitical environments. We have neither oil and gas. We have a booming economy. We are liberal-minded economy. We tripled our economy, that's true. We are one of the top destinations for investment, or have been until now. We have one of the lowest corruption rates in Europe, but we don't have millions of money to spend for anything, especially for lobbying.
Forgive me, then. Let's just nail one thing specifically, then we can move on, then. It has been widely reported that you have spent at least $900,000 with Orion Strategies, a lobbying company which is part-owned by Randy Schoenemann, who works for John McCain. Is that false or is that true?
All I can tell you, I mean, that Randy Schoenemann, I know him personally, but last time I met him was, I think, around 2 years ago. He was here with John McCain, who had a very nice trip with a number of senators. And John McCain has been a longtime supporter of our judicial reforms, legal reforms, democratization, Rose Revolution, fighting for democracy and fighting against corruption in this region. And that's what I'm grateful for. We certainly don't have any lobbying relations with John McCain, not people around him. Randy, I've known Randy before, but I can confirm, I certainly can confirm that we have no any hidden or some kind of occult relationship now with Randy, or especially with Senator McCain.
A non-denial denial, ladies and gentlemen, is what that's called in the trade. He denied occult relations, didn't deny the contract right out in the open, like the one apparently between January 1, 2007 and May 15, 2008, a period of time when Randy Schoenemann was both on the payroll of Orion Strategies, his own company, and the McCain campaign. At least $800,000 of Georgian money went to Orion Strategies between 2004 and May 15, 2008, according to the Center for Research on Globalization in Canada, ladies and gentlemen. I have to go to Canada to get this. No, it was covered in some of the American papers as well. Interestingly, the offices of Orion Strategies had the same address as the Iraqi National Congress, run by Ahmed Chalabi, who funneled all that bad intel to us. Why would that be? Chalabi was close to the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, which counted among its founding members Randy Schoenemann. And Schoenemann's Orion Strategies helped organize 10 members of the former Soviet bloc to support the invasion of Iraq. Reported by Ken Silverstein in the LA Times, Orion scored its biggest success when 10 Eastern European countries endorsed the U.S. invasion. According to U.S. News and World Report, Orion also represented Latvia, Macedonia, and Romania. Schoenemann's business partner on April 17th signed a $200,000 contract to represent Georgia. On the same day, McCain says he had a telephone conversation with Georgia's President Mikhail Saakashvili. The Washington Post reported that Schoenemann prepped McCain for that phone call. It's a plenitude of something. But ladies and gentlemen, on a related subject, possibly, a GOP congressional leader who was wavering on whether to give President Bush the authority to wage war in late 2002 said, this is a Republican congressional leader, said Vice President Cheney misled him by saying that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein had direct personal ties to al-Qaeda terrorists and was making rapid progress toward a suitcase nuclear weapon. This is in a new book about Cheney by Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman. Cheney's assertions, described by former House Majority Leader Dick Armey, that's what this country needs, came in a highly classified one-on-one briefing in room H208, the vice president's hideaway office in the Capitol. See, he really isn't a part of the executive branch. He has an office in the Capitol. What's your problem? The threat Cheney described to Army went far beyond public statements that have been criticized for relying on cherry-picked intelligence, including some supplied by Ahmed Chalabi. There's that name again. There was no intelligence to support the vice president's private assertions, according to Gelman's book, and they, quote, crossed so far beyond the known universe of fact, they were simply without foundation, unquote. That is, of course, the vice president's new charity, the Without Foundation. Army had spoken out against the war. He reversed his position after Cheney told him, he said, that the threat from Iraq was actually, quote, more imminent than we want to portray to the public at large, unquote. Well, that's credible, because you wouldn't want to scare the public. Cheney said, according to Army, that Iraq's ability to miniaturize weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear, had been substantially refined since the Gulf War and would soon result in packages that could be moved even by ground personnel. Why would you grind them? Oh, I guess it makes them harder to find. Add silicon to them and they float. Cheney linked the threat to Hussein's alleged ties to Al-Qaeda, Army said, explaining that, quote, we now know they have the ability to develop these weapons in a very portable fashion and they have a delivery system in their relationship with organizations such as Al-Qaeda. Quoting Army. Quoting Dick Army. Did Dick Cheney purposely tell me things he knew to be untrue? I seriously feel that may be the case. Had I known or believed then what I believe now, I would have publicly opposed the war resolution right to the bitter end, and I believe I might have stopped it from happening. Unquote, Dick Army. Make that 936.
Still could rise. Total what we were told before the war. 935 lies. 935 falsehoods told by our leading guys. Eyes of steel, tongues of fork. 935 lies. What a day. It'll take you 3 years to eat up 1,000 pies. But in a year and a half, we swallowed whole 935 lies. You know 1,000 clowns is a truckload. Rubber noses to the skies. But somehow it's not quite as scary as 935 lies. $1,000 will buy you a pretty good suite at the Ritz. Truffle dinner. Custom-made soup that fits. Yeah, $1,000 will buy you a pretty nice day at the store. But 935 lies will get you a $1 trillion war. 1,000 points of darkness pointing to a surprise. Guess what we were led to believe? 935 lies. And one nights were magic, filled with amazing tales. Alibaba and Aladdin, Sinbad and his sails. But 935 fictions, cut your hair as that down to size. Many more nights in Arabia, thanks to 935 lies. 935 falsehoods. Schnoz told 935 lies. Couple hundred thousand Iraqis said their early goodbyes. It's a gift that keeps on giving, thanks to 935 lies. 935 falsehoods told by our leading guys. Eyes of steel, tongues of fork. 935 lies.
This is Le Show, and now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, over a five-year period, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, they've added explosives to their remit, lost dozens of weapons and hundreds of laptops that contain sensitive information, that's all. That's according to a scathing report issued this week by the Justice Department Inspector General Glenn Fine. He identified serious deficiencies in ATF's response to lost or stolen items and called the agency's control of classified data inadequate. Aside from that, heck of a job. From 2002 to 2007, ATF, they haven't added the E, lost 418 laptop computers and 76 weapons. Two weapons were subsequently used to commit crimes. Nobody used the laptops to commit crimes? No hackers? What's wrong with you people? In one incident, a gun stolen from the home of a special agent was fired through the window of another home. Well, homes tend to be close together. 10 firearms were left in a public place. One of them was left on an airplane, 3 in bathrooms. Oh, I forgot. I was busy zipping up. 1 in a shopping cart and 2 on the top of cars as ATF employees drove away. Well, at least it wasn't hot coffee. A laptop also fell off the top of a car as an agent drove off. Well, again, at least it wasn't hot coffee. Because, you know, that really does happen. Another weapon fell into the water while an agent was fishing, according to the report. Talk about shooting fish in a... That seems like deja vu when you look back at previous reports outlining the same missteps by Department of Justice law enforcement agencies back in 2001, says Republican Senator Charles Grassley, who's criticized federal law enforcement agencies for failing to keep account of weapons and laptops. Keeping track of government property may seem like bookkeeping to some, housekeeping to some, but when it comes to guns and computers with sensitive information, it's critical to public safety, he says. The report showed that the ATF, a much smaller agency than the FBI, had lost proportionally many more firearms and laptops. The rate of loss was nearly double that of the FBI and the DEA. And the ATF did not even know whether most of its lost, stolen, or missing laptop computers contained sensitive or classified information, said the Inspector General. W. Larry Ford of the ATF's Office of Public and Governmental Affairs, i.e., their PR man. They couldn't afford Randy Scheuneman, apparently. Said the agency is committed to strengthening controls over weapons, laptops, and ammunition. Many of the missing laptops did, in fact, contain sensitive or classified material, according to the report. ATF only began installing encryption software in May of last year. Before that, it had been sitting on the top of a... No. ATF did not know what information was on 398 of the 418 lost or stolen laptops. The Inspector General called that lack of knowledge a significant deficiency. That's polite. Of the 20 missing laptops for which the ATF does know what was on them, 7 held sensitive information. 1 held 300 to 500 names with dates of birth and social security numbers, targets of criminal investigations, including bank records with financial transactions. Another held employee evaluations with social security numbers. Neither was encrypted. ATF employees did not report the loss of 365 of the 418 missing laptops. The report was less critical of the control of explosives, but when the Inspector General reviewed inventory records, he found that amounts on hand did not correspond with the amounts in record at 8 of 16 locations. Why, that's half. News from the inspector. Well, there's another report, comes from the Government Accountability Office, kind of similar. The American Red Cross and other disaster relief charities are unprepared to meet mass casualty needs during a natural catastrophe or a terrorist attack in major U.S. cities. A large-scale disaster would overwhelm the Red Cross. Didn't Ike do that? The report also faults the Federal Emergency Management Agency, hello FEMA, for not fully assessing the capacities of relief groups, and for not clearly documenting the roles that each should play in a disaster. FEMA is putting hurricane survivors in Texas and other hot weather states at risk, according to the investigative arm of ABC News, because FEMA is no longer providing ice. Yes, we knew that. They'd said they weren't going to. It's frustrating that the government can deliver $85 billion to bail out AIG and they can't deliver ice in Texas, said Ben Smilowitz of the Disaster Accountability Project, a nonpartisan organization that monitors the nation's disaster response. While the federal government can deliver ice to disaster areas, it's chosen not to under those newly revised FEMA rules we reported to you here. Oh, 2 months ago, individual states and local governments are now tasked with purchasing, delivering, and storing ice, even though they face tough logistical challenges in doing so, according to critics of the new policy. Mike Womack of the Mississippi Emergency Management Agency says FEMA is effectively saying we can't guarantee you ice. Ice is essential in maintaining temperature-sensitive medication, feeding formulas, and keeping people cool in the aftermath of disaster. This isn't for their gin and tonic, says the CEO of the Houston chapter of United Cerebral Palsy. FEMA says it instituted the new policy way back last year, although those in disaster relief circles widely point to the National Hurricane Conference in Florida this past April as the time when they announced the change. That's the first time watchdogs and local officials said they heard about the change just as hurricane season was about to begin. Since then, they've had no direction or guidance as to what the new procedures entail. I think they entail getting ice. But that's just me. Now, let's turn, if we may, ladies and gentlemen, to the troubled subcontinent, where, as you know, a big terrorist explosion took place in the capital of Pakistan this weekend. So I guess Iraq is the central front in the war on terror. The Pakistanis be laughing at that, bitterly laughing right about now. The Times of India says the United States is suddenly faced with the uncomfortable scenario of confronting the very same weapons and military hardware, including F-16 fighter jets, it armed Pakistan with for decades. Surfaced most starkly in the eyes over the Afghan-Pakistan border after the Pakistan Air Force deployed its U.S.-supplied F-16s to challenge the violation of its airspace by U.S. drones, and in one case, an airborne assault that landed U.S. Navy SEALs inside Pakistani territory. This, of course, from India. Wondering, and quoting others wondering, here we go, some lawmakers and analysts have long questioned the need for Washington to arm Pakistan with sophisticated fighter jets to counter al-Qaeda's and Taliban's diffused militias, many of whom are in Pakistan's towns and cities, and are patronized by Islamabad's intelligence agencies. Of course, India suspects that the purpose for those jets is not to fight al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It's to fight India. But India's hands, well, not quite clean. In January 2006, an Indian government agency purchased newspaper ads seeking help in building an obscure piece of metal machinery. The details of the project were laid out in a series of drawings that jolted nuclear weapons experts who discovered them. The blueprints depicted the inner workings of a centrifuge, a machine used to enrich uranium. Those drawings would be considered secret in most Western countries, but the Indian diagrams were available for a nominal fee, says David Albright, a former UN weapons inspector. He said he acquired the drawings for about $10 to prove the point. He calls the incident a serious leak of sensitive nuclear information. India has since tightened its bidding procedures, but the incident has fueled concerns among opponents of the U.S.-India nuclear agreement that Congress is expected to consider in coming weeks. Opponents say India's record on nonproliferation is not as unblemished as is claimed by the White House. Critics include former U.S. diplomats, military officers, and arms control officials. They accuse the White House of rushing the agreement without considering its long-term implications. This deal significantly weakens U.S. and international security, says retired Army Lieutenant General Robert Card of the Washington-based Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Well, of course, he's for arms control. Meanwhile, of course, we learned last week that the Pakistani nuclear smuggling ring run by AQ Khan had distributed more sophisticated information and materials, possibly more widely. But how would he distribute that information and train those people in this modern world?
Previously on Project Bombway.
You don't know anything about nuclear triggers. You'd barely know how to strap on your saddles.
At least I can wear saddles.
Tonight, what designer will win and when will be sent back to his home or insurgent group? I'm Heidi Vindaloo. Welcome to Project Bombway.
Hello, designers.
Hello.
Designers, today's challenge is fierce. Literally. Please welcome our very special guest to witness via closed-circuit video.
Oh.
From his prison cell in Ankara, Turkey, his noted suatcase bomb designer, Ergay Gürsel.
Oh, okay. Hello, designers. Today's challenge is, ironically, what I'm in a Turkish prison for, so please don't try this at home.
Okay.
Your challenge is to design a suitcase 20 kiloton device that this young lady can carry in her backpack from bluefly.com. Good luck.
Well, good luck to you, okay? You're the one in a Turkish prison.
Yeah, right.
Now, designers, you have 36 hours. And a 1,200 rupee budget. Let's go shopping.
A suitcase device for a backpack. This is what I was put on this earth to design. If I don't win this competition, may all my competitors be struck dead.
I don't even care if they don't like my design. I do bombs my way. I mean, I'm just here for the free apartment.
Designers, you have got a free phone line. And my personal database of suppliers. Make it work.
Hi. What's your best price on enriched uranium by the kiloton?
Who wants to know?
Who doesn't?
I'm the youngest bomb designer here, so I have to bring something fresh. I mean, just yesterday I went by way of the bazaar and came in with peaches for everybody.
We need the detonators by tomorrow morning at the latest.
I think we can do that.
Good. Put it on Bravo's tab.
Time's up, designers. Hang up those phones.
I think AQ's got something else going on.
Really? CIA kind of deal?
As if. No, I heard he sold syndication rights in the UK behind the networks.
Good morning, designers. One little extra wrinkle for today's work. You've been mapped on satellite surveillance. So you'll have to work in total darkness.
Stella, did you drop this?
I think so. It's either the pusher shell or a piece of my necklace.
I think Stella's freelancing. I can't imagine her fitting into any insurgent operation, but now that we're working in total darkness, at least I don't have to look at her stupid cleavage.
Muhammad's a fake. He couldn't design a working cherry bomb. He's just banking on Mujahideen cred. I mean, good luck.
I'm just saying, you can take my advice or not, but I don't have to be able to see it to know that that wire shouldn't be dangling loose. But, you know, make your own bomb.
Designers, 15 minutes to the bombway. Gather up your components. Let's go select your backpacks.
I know I nailed it. I mean, literally, it's full of nails. Just a little bonus to the explosive itself.
Designers, meet your judges. The internationally distinguished Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. Henry Kissinger, and Abu Nidal, one-time terrorist mastermind.
Mohammed, this isn't a bomb. This is a joke. The girl takes two steps, the vibration causes the detonator to go and poof, all over her backpack from bluefly.com.
Stella, this is a very elegant design. Very, if I may say so, very Viet Cong. Not that they had nuclear technology, but If they had, this is what they would have built.
Thank you.
Grady, you, the young boy?
Yes.
God does not smile on your practices. And your piece looked half completed, as if you'd left parts of it in the workroom.
I did. I ran out of time.
You did not have a screwdriver? I mean, I'm only glad Carlos the Jackal isn't alive to see this.
Mohammed, you can leave the bumway. You're in. Grady, you're out. Stella, congratulations. You've won.
Grady, I'm going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you too, AQ.
Let's go upstairs and pack your stuff together.
Bye, bro.
But Abinadal thinks it's so important for the device to look good when it's just going to blow itself up. It's beyond me. My piece would have kicked some street ass. That's all I can say.
Only two nuclear bomb designers left. And next week, there'd be only one. And designers, next week's challenge gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, the old fishing hole.
Next week on Project Bombway.
Was a fool with my money, and I lost every dime. When the sun stopped shining, it rained all the time. It did set me back some, but I made it through. But I'll never get over losing you. I'd get over losing anything, but I'll never get over losing you. When you're young in this time, you forget the past. You don't think that you will. I've been cold, I've been hungry, now for a while. I guess most of my dreams have come true. With it all here around me, no peace do I find, 'cause I never get over losing you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm.
Won't you? Really?
I think you will.
Soft, listen to the
warm. Mm-hmm. Let that vibrato just...
listen to the warm.
Just glide. Global warming and cleaner skies are making it rain more. Martin Wild of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology and his colleagues analyzed global measurements of solar radiation and rainfall taken between 86 and 2000. On average, surface solar radiation has increased and rainfall has increased as well. In recent decades, air pollution has dropped, so more sunlight is penetrating the atmosphere, says Wild. Meanwhile, rising levels of greenhouse gases are bouncing radiation back to the Earth's surface. Don't ask me how it's doing that. The extra energy has fueled an increase in evaporation. The intensification of the water cycle means more heavy precipitation events, more flooding, and more landslides, erosion, and overloading of water management systems. Unquote. Is that a bad thing? Did I mention that this is the award-winning news of the war? More than 750,000 years old, says New Scientist. Huge chunks of ice have survived through times when the planet was even warmer than it is today. Dwayne Froese of the University of Alberta and colleagues say their discovery, these huge chunks of ice, the oldest ice ever found in North America, could help us predict the fate of the deep Arctic permafrost and its frozen storage of methane. Don't let the methane out. It's worse than the dogs. Ice wedges form when spring melt water runs into fissures and then freezes. Thermal expansion widens the cracks and allows the wedge. I'll be with you in a moment here. To grow up to around 3 meters wide and 6 meters deep. And you metric folks, I know, will email me about how big that is. The team discovered the ancient ice several years ago at a site in the Canadian Yukon, just east of the Alaskan border.
I can see it from my porch.
It had been exposed by mining activities in the area. They were able to date it thanks to a layer of ancient volcanic ash, almost 5,000 years old, you know, when the Earth was created, that had been deposited a few dozen centimeters above its top margin. That ash was about 740,000 years old. Are you kidding me? Making the ice the oldest known in North America. Much of the ice in that region dates to the last 100,000 years, and most of the last 25,000, says the researcher. This means the Dominion Creek ice wedges must have survived two interglacial ages when it was warm. This illustrates how stubborn permafrost can be in the face of climate warming. Permafrost, for those of you who didn't pay attention in high school, is ground that remains frozen all year round, hence the name. This arrests the decay of vegetation, preventing the carbon which it contains from being released into the atmosphere. But these findings don't mean that the Arctic permafrost will survive the few degrees of warming predicted for the end of the century. All right, then. I'll think about that. Meanwhile, climate change could lead to a surge in cases of Legionnaire's disease, British government scientists have warned. In a story in the UK paper, The Telegraph, a study carried by the Health Protection Agency has found that higher temperatures and increases in humidity are linked with an increase in Legionnaire's disease cases. Study, one of the first of its kind in Europe, found that heat waves corresponded to higher cases of the disease than periods of more stable weather. The award-winning news of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, even when we don't know what it means, it fiercely remains a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Before we go, I mentioned that the dog trainer was looking into the future, or from the past into the present, regarding the land the Taliban controls. The Washington Post reports that just 1 year ago, the Taliban insurgency was a furtive, loosely organized guerrilla force that carried out hit-and-run ambushes. Today, it's a larger, better-armed, and more confident militia capable of mounting sustained military assaults. As we may have just seen this past weekend, its forces operate in virtually every province and control many districts in Afghanistan. Its fighters have bombed embassies and prisons, nearly assassinated the president of Afghanistan, and besieged or beheaded dozens of Afghans. The new Taliban movement has created a parallel government structure that includes defense and finance councils and appoints judges and officials in some areas. This is according to the Washington Post. It offers cash to recruits and presents letters of introduction to local leaders. It operates websites and a 24-hour propaganda apparatus. Rupert, that's a good idea. I already do it. This is not the Taliban of Emirate times. It is a new, updated generation, says Washid Mojda, a former foreign ministry aide under the Taliban Islamic Emirate, which ran Afghanistan. In the 90s, they are more educated and they don't punish people for having CDs or cassettes. The old Taliban wanted to bring Sharia, security, and unity to Afghanistan. The new Taliban has much broader goals to drive foreign forces out of the country and the Muslim world. The new Taliban, ladies and gentlemen, it's newer than the new Fords. And costs to run the coupon program that's helping people shift to digital television are about to exceed a congressionally mandated cap. The Bush administration is asking for more money for the coupons to help ease the transition to digital television. Because the money, we got the money. It's, oh. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I know you know that the federal government is now going to create this new financial institution to buy all the toxic, not my word, mortgages away from financial institutions to help the financial institutions, the private financial institutions, keep afloat. And there's some debate about what the name of that institution that buys these bad assets should be called. I'm thinking the Badass Bank. Doesn't that sound appealing? Hey, I want to do business with the Badass Bank. Why is it called that? Because it's got bad assets. I know, but it's badass. That's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America, on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the American Forces Network, and via your computer and the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, whenever you want it. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/listshow for members of audible.com. Available on XM and Sirius Satellite Radio, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like having non-toxic assets if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Thank you very much, A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks and to Pam Halstead. The show playlists and mailing address for the host are at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Let's not all be homeless. Stay solvent.